This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. As you heard a moment ago, you're listening to WGN, and we regularly visit with Craig Bolanos, the co-founder and CEO of Wealth Management Group. Craig, catch us up on what's going on this week right now.
Well, it's a busy week of economic data. You've even got Jerome Powell. He's going to be testifying in front of Congress on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Everyone's going to buckle their seatbelt and get ready for the big jobs data after a blowout jobs data in January. What are the results of February going to be? But today, we're learning that when Microsoft and Apple in particular control and influence so much of the market, if Apple has a bad day, the rest of the market has a bad day, and we're seeing some people take the chips off the table.
I thought you were going to say that about NVIDIA. It's Apple, not NVIDIA?
Well, you know what? Everything in, we call it the Magnificent Seven, whether it's Apple Computer, whether it's NVIDIA, you name the stock. I mean, they're all having a rough day. NVIDIA's down $2. That's about a quarter of 1%. But Apple is showing a little bit worse today. Apple's down $4 or 2.5%. And with Apple being the largest holding in the S&P 500, that's what's bringing the general numbers to the downside.
As one might expect, that is, if any of those or all of those are suffering, then so too will the index. But we have been talking with you and other guests on the Wintrust Business Lunch about how the indices are a little more broad-based right now. Do I recall that correctly? Are we seeing more companies participate on the upside?
Well, you know, if we think about that rally that started in October, continued into November and December, it was very narrow. But, John, you hit that nail on the head, as you always do on this show. In January and into February, we began to see this rally broaden out, where it wasn't just the Magnificent Seven. We had more of those 493 lesser-known companies begin to participate. But still, it's going to be a real focus just on the technology darlings, because the AI, the artificial intelligence revolution, it's kind of like the gold rush in San Francisco back in the 1800s.
Well, at least it's not Bitcoin or pets.com. I mean, the point is AI is real. It's here to stay. And if you did want to hitch your wagon to somebody, that would be a good driver of the market, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think AI has been the driver of the market. There is no doubt about it. And what everyone's trying to wonder now is AI going to be proven? It is real. When ChatGPT first came out, I mean, think about how incredibly transformative it was. And now the question becomes, will the other companies be able to adopt artificial intelligence to boost productivity and boost profits? Time is going to tell, but all indications based on how much companies are spending to buy these NVIDIA microprocessors, the semiconductors, everybody must believe it's a seminal change, at least until proven otherwise.
So when you say those other companies need to prove that it's profitable, you're not talking about other chip makers, you're talking about companies that use AI, right?
I am talking about, that's exactly right. I'm talking about all of the companies that use AI, all of the companies that are going to start adopting AI. That's the bottom line of this entire market. Is it really a seminal change? Because in the end, we have to see artificial intelligence make all of these non-technology companies a whole lot of money. Again, increasing revenue, sustainable cost savings. And I think the analogy I use is, you know, to that gold rush, John, if the Magnificent Seven are the picks and shovels of the AI gold rush, then the remaining companies in the S&P 500, they're the prospectors that are mining the gold. And if we find that the prospectors find enough gold, have widespread AI adoption, then this boom continues. It is a seminal event. But if there's not as much gold as everybody hopes in AI, we all know how the party's going to end, because we've lived through it before.
Yeah, suddenly I'm not so optimistic. That is, I think that's an interesting point. So I wonder if 10 years from now we're going to look back at AI and this moment in time as a moment of great hope, but it wasn't realized to the extent that we thought it might be. That's worth noting. We're talking to Craig Bolanos, the co-founder and CEO of Wealth Management Group. We mentioned Bitcoin a little bit ago, Craig. What's the latest on the currencies there?
Well, the world of cryptocurrency is a fire now that more people are involved and people have easier access, because there is not one, not two, but 11 ETFs that allow people to participate in Bitcoin. And you finally saw this past week Bitcoin go back to all-time highs. It wasn't that long ago that Bitcoin was trading at $64,000 in 2021. As you and I sit here today, we're at $65,000, and cryptocurrency investors are taking notice and smiling all the way to their digital online wallets and piggy banks.
I still don't know what cryptocurrency is supposed to be, because you just described it as an investment and we chart the value of it. But I thought it was invented as a currency, as a means of exchange, right?
Yeah, I mean, the whole concept behind cryptocurrency was to be able to have, without complicating it, this open peer-to-peer network where people could transfer funds without a central depository.
Right.
And you're right. I mean, originally it was used for nefarious reasons. There's no doubt about that. But due to all the issues on the planet, you know, you've seen them in Venezuela, you saw them in the island of Cyprus, you've seen them in different places. Some people view cryptocurrency not just as an investment, some people view it as a storage of value. I'm not trying to make the comparison to gold, but that's the lens through which some people see this. As far as its sustainable and stable power, John, your guess is as good as mine. Only time is going to tell.
Right, but people aren't buying and selling goods with gold being the currency of exchange. They're doing it with, you know, either electronic transfers or dollars, essentially. And while you can trade in currencies, we don't generally talk about the value of the dollar and am I going to buy or sell dollars. And I'm not sure which of those two camps Bitcoin or these cryptocurrencies have their feet in. Is it going to be essentially, ultimately, a means of exchange, goods for services, or is it going to be like gold and we're going to chart its value and invest in it that way?
I think the answer is both. John, I think the answer is both. I think the world continues to move towards a world of digital payments, good, bad, or indifferent. That's an entire other show. And I do think that we're going to look at Bitcoin and Ethereum, because that's what's next, not unlike when we had the gold ETF followed by the silver ETF 3 years later. I think we're going to look at it through a lens of an investment opportunity, and I think people are going to use it as a currency for the transfer and facilitation of goods and services.
Yeah.
How real is it? You know as well as I do, it's an entirely synthetic thing, but so are, you know, fiat currencies that aren't backed by gold standards across the world anyway.
Well, but it's just weird to me then that if it's that volatile, you know, if I owe you a Bitcoin today, tomorrow I might owe you six Bitcoin, or maybe I'll owe you a sixth of a Bitcoin, depending on the value of the thing. And that's just a calculation I'm not used to.
You're right, John. I would hate to overpay for my pizza, right? Given how volatile it is.
That's exactly. Talk to me about some of the movers and shakers on the market. Start with Super Microcomputers. I don't even know what that is.
Well, all you just said the word, so of course you know what it is.
Super microcomputer.
Yes. Think semiconductor, think demand. It goes back to everything that we talked about earlier today in that entire chip space. How much demand is there going to be? And a lot of this does have to do with another side of the pond, John. A lot of this has to do with China, because it appears that their economy is slowing. Their consumer is slowing. That slows down demand and consumption for everything that is technology across the globe. And that's just one more example.
But Super Microcomputers, that company, is up 25%, at least as of Monday. I'm not sure where they are today, but they seem to be doing pretty well.
Well, I mean, they had a fantastic pop in the same way you've had some retailers have a pop lately, right? Macy's had a good day. Target's having a fantastic day. It just shows the bifurcation in the market. You know, if you were to ask me specifically about Super Microcomputer and that big pop on Monday, well, hey, I mean, they got moved into the S&P 500. That forced every single index fund to buy the stock, hence the big rally. Remember, gaining entrance to the Dow Jones, gaining entrance to the S&P 500 is a very important goal for any publicly traded company because it creates a guaranteed outcome of buyers. That's a very big deal.
Now,
I was referencing the fact that it was down in price today with the rest of the semiconductors, but you're right. Monday was newsworthy.
Just a few seconds here, but what's your thought about the Fed and interest rates this year?
Again, my comment is the market is readjusting for lower expectations of rate cuts. 7 cuts, no way. 6 cuts, 5 cuts, 4, probably not. I'm hoping we get 2 to 3 because I need 2 to 3 to defend the valuations. But again, no rate cuts until at least June. It'll be celebrated by everybody, but savers with their high-yield money markets will instantly be disappointed.
I set the line at 3.5. You would have taken the under. Maybe I need to adjust the line to 2.5. If I said 2.5, would you take the under or the over?
At 2.5, I'm going to go with the over.
I like the way you said that. All right. That's Craig Bolanos, the co-founder and CEO of Wealth Management Group. Invest with WMG.com. Thank you, Craig.
Good to be with you, John.
So let's visit with Dennis Rodkin, the senior reporter covering residential real estate for Crain's Chicago Business. He comes in here frequently to tell us about not only some interesting properties, but sometimes interesting trends or issues around real estate. You want to start with interesting properties or interesting trends today?
Whichever way you want to go, John. There are some great ones on the market.
Well, let's just talk about this house in Wilmette that was part of Frank Lloyd Wright's this is his definition of affordable housing?
Yes. In the 1910s, he was working with a company in Milwaukee to design what he called the American system-built homes. They were smaller than his wealthy clients were buying, but they were the same level of design. When you go to Milwaukee, you can see a group of four of them in a row. There weren't many built because he's doing this in the World War I years, and eventually materials became too hard to get. So, but there is one in Wilmette. There are about four in our region, two in Beverly. And this one, 3 years ago this month, sold without even going on the market. When the agent for it at the time posted on Facebook that she was there taking pictures, another agent walked over from a few blocks away, took a look, put in an offer for her client, sold it for full price, $635,000, I think. It's coming on the market this week. That buyer from 2021 has done a lot of rehab, put in a really nice kitchen.
I'm looking at that. It is nice.
Yeah, did a couple of other things, created a primary bath, which you rarely get in a 1917 house unless it's been fully remodeled. Did a lot of work to it and now is asking $899 for it. And so it wasn't even going to go on the market until tomorrow. But already people have been looking at it. The agent couldn't really confirm for me that she has offers in her hand, but I'll bet she does. And she's not going to look at any of them till Sunday. So there's still time for people to look. But given the interest, I would not be surprised if Sunday they put it under contract. And I also would not be surprised if it goes for over the asking price of $899.
How many square feet?
It's about 1,400 square feet. Some of that is not original. It was a very small house, and sometime over the years, they added about half more. There's a porch that was turned into a foyer sitting room. The primary bedroom is an addition. They look like the original from Wright. It was all done very well. Nobody's quite sure when it was done. It's really a sharp-looking house. I mean, it's got all the things you expect, the wood banding, the beautiful brick fireplace at the center of the home. The kitchen was done sort of sympathetically to the original look. It's a very pretty house, but it is far smaller than what you think of when you see, you know, the big ones in Oak Park and places like that.
Trying to figure out if 1,400 square feet and $900,000 go together.
In Southeast Wilmette? Yeah.
That's not off the chart.
No, one of the things I said in the story is essentially you're not going to find another house for under $1 million in that part of, you're down in that southeast part of Wilmette where you can walk to Gilson Park, take a look at the Baha'i Temple, walk to the CTA as well as to Metra. Most houses in there are $2 million or more. This is a relic of an older version of Wilmette, a more expensive version of that neighborhood. I mean, a less expensive version of that neighborhood.
Yeah. If you improve a Frank Lloyd Wright house, do you devalue a Frank Lloyd Wright house?
I think it depends on how, it depends on what you call improving it. In this case, I would say they didn't, because the kitchen fits really well. I have seen houses where people sort of try to bend it and stretch it and make it work, and that's difficult. But generally, the right owners go with a Frank Lloyd Wright designer, architect, and really try to stay sympathetic, at least in our generation. In the 50s, 60s, people were trying to make them look like modern houses. Now people really try to keep it sympathetic, and I don't know that you devalue it. I think you help it.
Well, could I tell a builder, build me a Frank Lloyd Wright house, either take the blueprint off the internet or make something akin to that? Or do people build Frank Lloyd Wright houses?
Oh, yeah. There was a flourishing of those in the early 2000s when Frank Lloyd Wright, when craftsmen and all those sorts of things had come back into style in a big way. There are a lot of homes coming on the market now that were built during that period. I did one. We might have talked about it. I can't remember the numbers. I'd have to look it up. But up on the far northwest side, I think Sauganash or up around in there, it was pretty close to a replica of Roby House. And it sold very quickly. It had been built something like 15 years before. It sold fast. I don't know if it sold for the full asking price. But if you look, they're all over. There are these, I call them neo-right houses.
How would you describe the real estate market in Chicago right now, or Chicagoland?
You know, we have so many cross signals. Prices still going up quite a bit. Inventory still very tight. Prices have gone up even though interest rates have risen back up. They were coming down at the end of 2023. They've been rising through most of 2024. They're high. You know, they're above where they were nearly the entire 21st. Well, I guess at this point, they're back up to above the entire 21st century previous. Yet people are buying. And that's in part because I've got to move.
Yeah.
And they're paying higher prices even with those interest rates because there's so little inventory on the market.
Do you think this is going to unleash the logjam, not 3%, but time? After a while, people will say 6% is the market. And I don't feel foolish for paying that amount for the money.
You know, I think that is releasing the logjam just slowly. You know, we have to come to terms. We're a married couple. I'm ready to lose the money because I want to move. The other person in the couple says, you know, we really have a great mortgage rate here. I don't want to lose any money. Eventually you come around because we both really want to live near the grandkids or whatever it is. Yeah, I think people are coming around. When would it be? In early 23, late 22, there was a popular phrase from real estate agents, marry the house, date the rate. Because what they wanted you to think is, you know, interest rates will change. Oh. You'll be fine. And most people have figured out if you're dating that rate, you're kind of handcuffed to that rate because they've just continued going up. But yeah, I think that people are getting used to it. Also, the other thing to keep in mind is new people come into the market. I'm young, or for whatever other reason, I wasn't in the market to buy a home. The fact that interest rates were lower before is immaterial to me. Now is when I want to buy a house. And so I think as we see that prices continue to go up, even though interest rates are down, then I think sellers start to say, well, I can get a pretty good number. And maybe that mitigates the fact that I'll go from my low interest rate on what I have to a higher interest rate on what we buy.
Maybe 6% is going to look good if the market goes back up.
And yeah, if it ever goes down now.
Refinance if it gets to 4. Right? I mean, there's no...
If it does in the term of your life in the house get down that far, sure, refinance. But well, I think it's also true that, you know, people may buy less than they would have a couple of years ago. We were going to retire into a 4-bedroom house. We'll retire into a 2 or whatever it would be because we, you know, what we can afford is different from what we could have afforded in the early 2020s. But yeah, I think that people are gradually and some quickly getting used to the fact that this is where interest rates are now.
And, you know, all of us boomers love to trot out that I bought my first home and it was 13%.
Yeah.
And that's true, by the way. We're talking to Dennis Rodkin, the senior reporter covering residential real estate for Cranes. I do want, after a quick check of some business numbers here, Dennis, to have you at least tell us what the real estate community or the community in Chicago generally is saying about this debate over a real estate title transfer tax. The idea being that for most people, they would pay less for the title transfer. They would get a discount. And if your property is worth more than $1 million or $1.5 million, you will pay more. We'll pick it up here in a minute with Dennis. Let's get you more business news first. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. New stats show the retail vacancy rate in Chicago's Loop increased to 30% in 2023. That's the fourth year in a row the vacancy rate has gone up, according to a report from Stone Real Estate, a retail brokerage firm that tracks Loop vacancies. The figure is up from 28% in 2022, and it's more than double the pre-pandemic rate of 15%. Analysts say ongoing remote work for office workers is mostly to blame. The latest figures show only about 55% of Chicago workers are back in the office. The latest job cuts at Rivian included 100 workers laid off in Illinois. Those cuts happened at the electric vehicle maker's assembly plant in downstate Normal. Rivian employs about 8,000 workers in Normal, and most of them are hourly workers who produce electric trucks, delivery vehicles, and SUVs. The staff also includes engineers and designers. Last month, the company announced a 10% cut of salaried workers. Rivian's trying to cut costs after losing $1.5 billion in the fourth quarter. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
We've got the business of food with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And here's something to think about as you sip your morning cup of joe or that mid-afternoon coffee pick-me-up.
Coffee itself was really at the core of the transatlantic slave trade.
Who she is, and more about the dark and bitter history of coffee, after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Jasmine Nevels and her sister Danielle are CEOs of Uncharted Coffee Company. Here's Jasmine again as we go back to the beginning.
Coffee was founded in Ethiopia by a goat herder.
It still grows wild there.
And it kind of made its way to the Middle East, then to India, and then unfortunately, the Dutch realized they could colonize and use this for mass production.
And historians say over the next 400 years, more than 11 million Africans were enslaved on coffee plantations.
It was one of the crops that actually helped fuel slavery into this part of the world.
And in Latin America, people of color were exploited and enslaved, too, in the name of coffee. So here we are, centuries later. How are things? Better, but not great, say researchers at the University of Utah. Of the 125 million people in Africa, Asia, and Latin America who grow and process coffee, 71% live in extreme poverty. And let's do something, said the Nevels sisters, who were born and raised in Chicago. They started their own coffee company, and they're trying to revolutionize the industry one cup at a time.
We want to decolonize coffee by educating people about what the issues in coffee are. We actually go to these farms and meet the farmers, understand more about their farming practices, ensure the quality of materials that we're sourcing, build that relationship, and then bring the product back.
The Neville sisters say each coffee bean they import and roast carries the story of its origin, the soil, where it was grown, and the hands that nurtured it.
So we think it's really important for people to understand where your product comes from so that you can understand from farm all the way to the cup at your kitchen table.
Jasmine and Danielle Nevels, you can find their coffee at drinkuncharted.com. On the food calendar, today's National Cheese Doodle Day. Is that a food? That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
We're talking about residential real estate with Dennis Rodkin, the senior reporter on that beat at Crain's. Describe for me in 30 seconds the real estate title transfer tax proposal.
When you buy or sell a property. You pay a transfer tax. You pay, in the city of Chicago, you pay a certain amount. Both the buyer and the seller pay a small percentage. It's a one-time tax. So in a sense, it's more like a fee. And for the past several years, there has been a proposal to use that transfer, to use an increase in that transfer tax to fund programs in the city to fight homelessness. It has taken various shapes, but the most recent one was, it was put on the ballot as a referendum in the city. Should we raise the transfer tax by a certain amount for every purchase over $1.5 million? And that's both residential and commercial properties. Far more commercial properties are up there in that over $1.5 million. Raise it by a little less for $1 million to $1.5 million and drop it for purchases under $1 million. That's the compromise version that Mayor Johnson rolled out, I think in September, maybe October, that ended up as a referendum on the March ballot in the city. But now it's in question, as I think you were discussing earlier, because there have been rulings that the way it is phrased is unconstitutional.
You can only ask one question in a ballot initiative, so the question would be, should we raise it? And in fact, when they've put that to the city council, they didn't want to do that at all.
Exactly.
So they said, all right, well, how about we put it on the ballot, and we say, but we'll lower it for 90% of the properties. And that was
90% of the residential properties. Let's be clear. It's not 90% of commercial sales that go for under $1 million. It is 90% of residential sales that go for under $1 million.
They're selling it to people as 90% of homeowners will see a reduction in the and that's true for homeowners.
For homeowners.
So what does the world say about that? Oh, and by the way, because you therefore have two questions, raise it for them, lower it for them. That's two issues. You can only have one at a time. That's why it's in jeopardy on the ballot.
Well, it actually comes down to three questions on the ballot. As I was describing, it's $1 million, $1.5 million, and then everything above. So it came down to three questions on the ballot. And one thing I want to throw in here is because this tax is incremental, and so if you're buying at over $1.5 million, you have also bought at that first $1 million level. I did the math, and this tax doesn't really kick in until you pay $1.12 million because the decrease on below $1 million is bigger than the increase until you get to $1.12 million.
Oh, right. The increase isn't on the entire value.
It's only on the amount above
$1 million values.
And then above $1.5 million. So what are people saying about it? Is that your question? The real estate industry, and I want to be clear, I'm not a mouthpiece of the real estate industry. I cover them arm's length like I cover everything else. The real estate industry has been pretty upset, in part because they say, you know, how does homelessness come from people buying homes? Why is this the place to come up with the money? That's one thing. Another is both the residential in the city and the commercial markets have been struggling, and the commercial market has really been struggling. One of my colleagues reported this week that the Loop is more vacant than it is, is one-third vacant for the first time ever, Loop commercial space. So if you add to these costs, the idea is you're going to have a harder time bringing our commercial real estate sector back. And then the third that argument they have made is the city has so far said, we'd like this money, we think it'll raise about $100 million, and we will use it to fight homelessness, but hasn't said we will spend $50 million on this and $20 million on that, hasn't shown a specific
plan. Where's the
plan? That's the argument that people have made. However, the supporters of the Bring Chicago Home initiative say what we would do is set up a community board that would make recommendations on anti-homelessness programs to the city council. So to them, that is offering specifics. So that's why the real estate industry has been pushing against it. Some people haven't been all that vocal because they all agree we want to fight homelessness. And in every interview I have with people in the real estate industry, they say, we'd like to help fight homelessness. They have the concerns I just listed.
I don't know if it was a conversation I had with the mayor. He's only been on with us a couple of times and is loath to talk about this, it seems, in an unstructured interview with a sit-down with us. But he says something along the lines of, if we clean up Chicago, if we get these people homes, if we make them better participants in the economy and the ecosystems of Chicago, then it'll be more attractive to businesses. This is an investment in the place that your employees are going to live and work. Blah, 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 blah. That's what they say.
Well, I don't know how to counter that because, again, I'm not partisan in this. But I would say I think a lot of people are thinking that we have so many problems in Chicago, so many interrelated problems, not only homelessness, but crime and the departure of big companies, that I don't know that you can draw a direct line between cleaning up homelessness and
without
solving
addressing
all
those other issues.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what Bring Chicago Home means. Like, okay, the homelessness problem. Are we talking about the people in the viaducts? Or are we talking about, you know, who are living in tents? Or are we talking about people who are just in poor housing? Tell me exactly what this means.
It's creating housing for people who do not have homes. It's improving housing for, you know, there's a lot of doubling up. There's a lot of talk of the doubling up. My family is all crowded into a property.
Okay, so is the city, so what about that? So is the city going to build houses? Are they going to give loans to people to buy houses that aren't on the, don't exist?
Well, so this is the complaint that Illinois Realtors and others have aired, is that those questions you've just asked haven't been answered. But as I said, the supporters say, well, you know, once we know that this income stream has been created, we will set up a commission to describe what needs to happen. Will there be housing built? How? What will be the wraparound?
A lot of Chicagoans don't trust the city giving them that money and not knowing what they're going to do with it.
That is, yeah, that's one of the things that the opponents have said repeatedly.
Dennis Rodkin writes about real estate for Crane's Chicago Business. You can read him at chicagobusiness.com. Nice to see you, Dennis.
Thanks, John.